This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are now, the United Nations tells us, 7 billion people on this planet. Sooner rather than later, another 30, maybe 35 years or so, there's going to be more than 9 billion people. It's a whole lot of mouths to feed. So today we're starting a year-long series about the global food system and how we're going to feed those 9 billion people if we're going to be able to feed them at all. We start by way of illustration at dinner. You can kind of think of the world's food system as a giant potluck dinner.
Hello, come in.
Come in.
The first thing that strikes you is the abundance. There's a huge table. It's piled with food. And the smells.
Magnifico.
Wow, what is that?
It's a goat stew. Try some.
50 years ago, people were eating a lot less, on average, especially meat.
They have a hamburger. It's delicious.
Back in the 60s and 70s, about 1 billion people, one in every 3 human beings, were hungry. Millions of people were dying in famines in China and Africa and Bangladesh. People worried there was no way to keep up with an exploding population. But then came the Green Revolution, and over the course of just a couple of decades, global food production skyrocketed. Famines are now actually pretty rare. We're producing more food, and we're better at dealing with emergencies. But even with that, things aren't exactly working. Down at this end of the room, there's a family sitting on the floor with a few grains of something. It looks like millet. The number of chronically hungry people in the world is still around 1 billion. Granted, that's 1 in 7 of us, not 1 in 3. But still, it's a lot. And clearly, something's out of whack, because there are also about 1 billion obese people worldwide. Actually, a lot of things are out of whack. Back here in the kitchen, the water system's all messed up. There's too much in some places, not enough in others. There's a big pile of rotting something over there, and man, it's getting hot. And crowded, too. There's hardly any room to move. Here comes another busload of people. They look hungry, too. And so a question you might draw from such a scene setter is, now what are we supposed to do? More than 9 billion people. So over the course of the next year, in collaboration with Homelands Productions and PBS NewsHour, we're going to be looking at what we have to do now to be able to feed ourselves in the future. And maybe one place to start is science. Can't we just research and develop our way out of this? Because it's worked before. Here's John Miller.
I figured Mexico was a good place to go to take a look into the scientific pipeline. This is where farmers thousands of years ago transformed a grass called teosinte into what we now know as corn. It's also where scientists in the 1950s and 60s developed the semi-dwarf wheat varieties that launched the Green Revolution. My first stop is where a lot of that work was done, at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center outside Mexico City. I'm here watching technicians clean and sort experimental corn seeds to go out around the world. I ask research director Marianne Banziger if there's some big game changer on the horizon. She says, basically, forget about it.
It is not just one solution. I mean, our action plans are 10 approaches, and the 10 approaches are not just breeding, they are about really looking at the whole livelihood of a farm family.
So the idea isn't just to increase the total amount of food the world produces, it's also to make life better for the 2 billion or so people who depend on farming for their food and livelihood. Because ironically, most of the world's poorest and hungriest people are in the food production business. If they can produce more, the thinking goes, everybody benefits. Banziger says for most crops, a good place to start is by closing what's known as the yield gap. That's the difference between what farmers could be producing using existing technology and what they actually do produce.
In Africa, under the best conditions, you can get 10 times more yield than what farmers get today. On average, I would say in Africa, we can increase production 4 or 5 times.
In Asia and Latin America, she figures output could double. Actually realizing those gains, well, that's the challenge. I go on a little field trip to see Porfirio Bastida, who farms just over an acre of corn near the Mexico City airport. The city's been creeping closer and closer, sucking up water and land. For the last 3 years, Bastida's been practicing what's known as conservation agriculture. He doesn't plow and he doesn't hoe, and he lets the stalks and leaves of the corn plants stay in the field after harvest. American farmers have been doing this for decades to control erosion, but here it's a pretty radical departure from the way people normally farm.
Mire, en primer lugar,
hemos visto que pues ya no tenemos suficiente agua.
Yeah, so basically, Porfirio is saying that they decided to use conservation agriculture because they don't have much water available for their crops. When they keep all the organic material on the soil, that helps the field to retain humidity.
Bastida says he's using much less water now, and he's harvesting twice as much corn. Plus, it's less work. Still, of all the farmers in this area, so far only he and his wife have adopted the method. Take-home message? It takes time for new things to catch on. I spend the next day tromping around cornfields with Fernando Castillo, a Mexican geneticist who teaches at a nearby university. Working with a tiny budget, he helps local farmers improve the way they select the corn they'll save for planting the next season. These are traditional varieties, not hybrids or GMOs, and since Mexico is where corn comes from, there's lots of genetic diversity in any given field. Castillo says with a little tutoring, Mexico's 2.8 million corn farmers can accomplish much more than a few plant breeders with PhDs.
Farmers have worked for years, and they have learned from their parents and grandparents the local conditions and the management. So most of it is based on local knowledge and local resources.
Castillo says the process could raise Mexican corn yields by 2% per year, which is just about what's needed to keep up with the demand. But he's been at this for 15 years, and he's still just working with a handful of farmers. Around the world, thousands of scientists are hacking away at thousands of problems. Some are experimenting with agroecological methods, mixing different crops and trees and animals to diversify diets and reduce the need for chemical fertilizers. Others are trying to breed crops that resist insects or diseases, or that tolerate flooding or drought. Some of this stuff is pretty ambitious.
This field contains the first experiment of the Wheat Yield Consortium in Mexico.
Matthew Reynolds is a wheat specialist at the Maize and Wheat Center. He's heading a global push to make wheat plants much more efficient at converting sunlight into grain. There's a parallel effort going on in rice.
This is actually a very interesting area, the spike photosynthesis, because no one has ever systematically tried to improve this photosynthesis of the spikes.
It's not just about the spikes. Those are the parts of the plants with the seeds on them. It's about fundamentally changing the way the plant works. Reynolds says the research will take 20 or 30 years to bear fruit, if it bears fruit at all. But it could increase wheat yields by 50%.
So what are the odds? The answer to that question is more, what are the consequences if we fail?
But no one is really counting on the project succeeding. There are just too many scientific uncertainties. So the strategy for now is to keep working on as many fronts as possible. With climate change and another 2 or 3 billion people coming, I ask Marianne Banziger if it'll be enough.
We can feed the world in 2050. Maize is the livelihood for 900 million poor people. Wheat feeds more than 1.2 billion poor people. Yeah. So it is a little bit absurd to think that the resources are not there. They are there.
Still, everyone I talk to here says no matter how generous the funding, no matter how good the science, it won't make a difference if government policies aren't right. That means fair prices for farmers and help when crops fail. It means access to land and roads and warehouses and markets. It means education and nutrition programs and family planning. But you can't just wait for all those things and then call in the scientists, because if there's one resource scientists need more than anything, it's time. In Texcoco, Mexico, I'm John Miller for Marketplace.